Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are a father and daughter. They're from Spittal in County Galway and they're both full of energy and enterprise. Eimear Ní Chéide is the CEO of Fuinse, the Irish language newspaper. She bought the brand in 2009 and a distribution deal with the Irish Independent means that the newspaper has multiplied its readership under her leadership. Her father is Pádraig Ó Cadhaigh. He's a man who embraces change, having worked as an accountant, a teacher, a solicitor before becoming CEO of Air Éireann. He has just stepped down as chairman of that company, but continues to develop new business ideas. He's currently chairing the judges panel for this year's Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Awards. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
What's your earliest memory of your dad, Eimear?
I'm sure I have lots of them. I remember especially one of his graduations in NUIG, probably because of what I was wearing. So I just remember these beautiful white socks with frills on the end of them and new white shoes and a flowery dress. So yeah, I remember that. I remember that day. It was a lovely day.
It's really sweet. Because you were quite a young father, weren't you, when you had Eimear Pádraig?
Oh, absolutely. What age was I? I was 26.
Okay.
When Eimear was born. Obviously, Eimear's our first child, and the first child's a big, big occasion, so you don't know what to expect. It's something new and something different, and it actually starts really to kind of bring a family together and create a family, because otherwise it's just two people. It's people, two people living together, but when a child comes along, it's a totally different synergy altogether. It's fantastic.
Was he strict, Eimear, when you were growing up?
He was always easier to get around. If Mom had said something, that was it, whereas you could always change his mind. In theory, he was stricter, but in practice, you could always get him to change his mind, which was great.
I didn't know that.
Now you do. You spent a lot of time with Pádraig's parents and your grandparents when you were young.
We all lived on the same by road, aunts and uncles and grandparents and everything. So you spent every single day with them. My grandfather used to pick us up from school and bring us home to my grandmother's. And I'd go away for weekends away with her to Cork to visit her sister Janie and stuff. So I remember as a child begging Mom and Dad to go out so my granny could come and babysit us, just to spend time with them, you know. It was a lovely experience.
It's such a lovely relationship, I think, grandparents and grandchild.
You know, you respect them, so you knew never to cross the line with them, but they never needed to discipline us because we enjoyed spending time with them so much, you know, be it going up and down the road or through fields or, you know, baking a cake or whatever. It was just such a lovely time to spend with them and to know them so well now and having that, where some of my cousins who are a lot younger may not have that relationship with them. So it was great to be able to have that.
And your dad has passed on, hasn't he, poor Grandad? But your mum, Rita, is still alive.
She's fine and she's living at home and she's in her early 80s now. And she reminisces a lot about her time in Ballyconneely. She's from Ballyconneely originally and growing up there. And that was a different world to the world that I grew up in, which is a different world to the one that you're grown up in, Eimear. So it's interesting how things move on. But as Eimear says, the connection with who you are and your roots is, I think, are really important.
Tell us a little bit about your mum.
She grew up in Truska, which is close to Imlaharn in Ballyconneely. Everybody knew each other. Everybody helped each other out. All of the neighbours would come together to cut turf collectively and cut the hay and save the hay collectively. And then at night time, most nights of the week, particularly in the summertime, you'd have a session, a bit of a ceilidh at someone's house, and everybody come around and they'd go dancing and so on. And my mother's family, her brothers and father and so on, were very musical. They played the accordion and tin whistle and so on. So that was the kind of local recreation and bit of crack. But it was all based around people and family and community and togetherness, which was fantastic.
Must have been a big shock though, when you think at 17, when you think of 17-year-olds today, but when your mum was 17, didn't she head off to England?
Yeah, she and my Aunt Janie, God be good to her, headed off to Scotland first of all and worked there for a while. And Janie met a Mayo man there, Paddy Roach, and settled down and got married. And my mother then moved down to London and she worked in London. And it was daunting, but while in London, she met my father at an Irish dance hall, the Galty Moor.
Yeah, it's and a famous
It
story,
is, it's
actually,
well
yeah.
known, absolutely. And there are lots of love stories, I think, came out of the Galty Moor. And it's got a lot to answer for, but and I'm probably one of those
You're
things to answer.
You're a product of it.
I'm a product of it. And they got married in London and came back to Spittal, where my father's family are from. And he got jobs locally working on building sites and so on. And my mother, Rita, she got jobs in was the local toy factory and knitting yarn sweaters and so on. And there's five of us in the family. I'm the oldest. And we all went to primary school in Spittal. And one of my best friends at the time, great man called Martin O'Donnell, he's got a shop in Spittal at the moment. He was going to a school in Galway, a Jesuit school. I didn't know what a Jesuit school was. But he said, look at this great crack, come on in with me. So that was my career guidance. He was my career guidance counsellor. And I went there and I had six fantastic years in the Jes. But I found it very difficult at first because the rural environment I came from was so different to the city environment that the vast majority of kids were coming from. But gradually I got into it and I played a lot of sport and that helped out. And they were absolutely amazing years.
Do you think that has helped in your success?
Undoubtedly so, undoubtedly so. The Jesuit education, it's pluralist, it's all-encompassing. They look at developing the person rather than purely points for exams and so on and so forth. They individualize learning, they focus on you as an individual, and they actually focus on the positive. They're not the type of people who say, look at, you're not a good person or you'll never learn this. They'll say, okay, that's fine, that's good. Let's see, can we go further? So there's incredible encouragement there. And a lot of students in the Jes have and continue to do really, really well in life.
Where does the entrepreneurial streak come in the family? I mean, you possibly got it from your dad, Emer, but where did you get it from, Paul?
That's a really good question because one of my staff, great young lady, Deborah Kennedy, Debs Kennedy, she nominated me for the Entrepreneur of the Year program, the Ernst Young Entrepreneur of the Year program. And to be honest with you, I didn't know what an entrepreneur was. And I had to figure out who are these kind of people, what do they do? And I, over time, I discovered what it was. And my sense is that my father was a bit of an entrepreneur. So he was, you know, he thought outside the box and he would have looked at doing things different. He would challenge the norm. And I'd say it probably came from there. But I don't think it's necessarily in the genes. I think it comes from somebody who says, look, I want to try and make a difference in life. And they actually go and they challenge themselves and they challenge the status quo in creating something new or something different.
You need a big work ethic, though. Is it true you picked periwinkles to buy
your
first bicycle?
That's true, yeah. That's true. I've come from a very, very working class background and we didn't have a lot of money. So it was standard practice for me and for a lot of guys on the village and in Spittal to actually do stuff like go down to the seashore, pick periwinkles and sell them on the market or whatever. And you save a few bob then and buy a bicycle because I needed a bicycle because we were about 3 miles from the school. So it was a necessary way of transport. Yeah, it was need must and you just go there and do it.
And you, Emer, do you think you have got your entrepreneurial streak from your dad or you'd have had it anyway?
I wouldn't class myself personally as an entrepreneur, more so of a hard worker.
And you're CEO of Winch, right? Do you think it's harder being a woman than a man in that world?
Yeah, I do think women have some challenges towards them, especially how men perceive them as being weaker. But I think we can use it for our strengths. I mean, I always, if I'm ever feeling a little bit worried or down, I'm always like, okay, I'm going to look better than any of these men anyway, because I can do my makeup and my hair and wear the nice dress or whatever. And I get my confidence as well because you're seen as the underdog and you can prove to them that actually, you know, you've got something ahead of them and I have so much knowledge. And I feel like I can surprise people a lot more because they don't expect that much being 28 years old, being female, and you're in an office full of men who are in their late 50s who've been doing it all their lives. And I do tend to surprise them with my knowledge and expertise. So I enjoy that.
Did you learn much from your father?
I think I've learned everything. Yeah. I mean, we've always been immersed in work. You know, it's always been at home. He's always had an office at home. You were always asked to help when you could. I think that all of us have that experience and have learned so much from him. Like even, for example, I get people in on work experience and I'm sometimes very disappointed because, you know, all of my siblings, Cahal, Trina and Fáinse, we've always worked. We're always very used to it. So I expect everyone to have the same level as them. I can tell Fáinse, 19 years old, answer all those emails, answer all those phone calls, do this, that and the other. I can say to my 21-year-old sister, you know, can you lay out the whole paper without any training? And I know she's going to do it. But I think it's because all of our lives we've been surrounded by hard work and we were always taught and believed that you could never fail. If you put the hard work and the effort in, you're going to succeed.
Do you find, as the daughter of Pádraig O'Cadhain, at first people compared you or patronised you, or neither of those?
I think as a teenager, when I was finding my steps and maybe into my early 20s, it was something that I always tried to shy away from because I wanted to become my own person. And, you know, especially with sponsoring Galway football, and you're on a night out and the footballers are all there and everyone's excited and, you know, your friends want to go talk to them, so they use you as a little celebrity, as Pádraig's daughter. It's something I tried to run away from because I wanted to be known as my own person and everything. Yeah. And I think I have carved that out for myself. But I mean, you know, it's an honour to be so close to someone and to have someone that you can ask these questions of, be it personal or business, at any time of day or night.
I don't know. I'd say I hope she learned all good things from me. I'm not sure, to be honest with you. Probably one of the most proudest moments for me in relation to Emer is when she took over Fuinse and made such a really, really, really good job at the newspaper and actually reinvented the newspaper. Because before that, the newspaper was selling maybe 4,000 to 4,500 copies a week. And the style of the newspaper was focused on people who are strong Irish readers, Gaelgoirí out, which is fine. But then the newspaper had to change to suit the public domain, the Irish independent reader. And that's a totally different psychology of a reader.
Much broader.
Absolutely. And that was an incredible challenge. And quite frankly, Emer, I never said this to you, but from day one, she nailed it. Her and some of the people who you took on in Fuinse, you know, that to me was incredible. With a really small staff to produce a national newspaper like that, that 120,000+ people would read on a weekly basis, on a shoestring.
You use photographs well, I always think, as well. It's very easy to pick it up and want to read it.
Well, I think it's very important to have photographs. It's what our eyes are drawn to before we're drawn to text. So, but it wouldn't be what it is without the input of all of, mainly girls, apart from Mórtín Ócáirín, who's our male in the office. But, you know, without Una and Sharon and Nasa and Trina, who helps out as well, without them all in the office, it wouldn't be what it is. I don't stand there and dictate this is what should be. It's everyone together giving their opinions and looking at the pages and looking at possible storylines to see what will everyone want. Will this appeal to the Gaelgoirí, but also appeal to the learner, and how can we write it in such a way that all can read it and get some enjoyment from it? So thankfully it's worked so far, and so far so good.
You're both eldest children. Do you think that makes you driven or extra hardworking or more responsible?
That's a great question. I never thought about that, quite frankly. There is a survey out there on entrepreneurs that the majority of entrepreneurs are the oldest children.
Wow,
interestingly enough. I've just written a book on entrepreneurship. It's been edited at the moment. And when I was doing research for it, that's one of the statistics or one of the pieces of information I found out. So there may be something there, Miriam. I'm not sure.
I wonder why that would be.
Yeah, it could be. It could be that there's a sense of greater responsibility on the oldest child. There's also a sense of the oldest child could be helping with the younger siblings and so on and so forth. That could also be a factor. It could also be a factor that sometimes, like, some people would say that there's a lot more attention given to the first child, as it were, and so on.
And after that,
sure, look at, they're all right.
What do you think, Emer?
I would dispute the attention for the eldest child.
I knew you
would. You don't get to go to the discos that you want to, that the younger children can
strict,
go to, and they're so much more strict on you. I feel that our family, anyway, you know, we'd all be very responsible. I don't feel like that I have that particular trait that the other three wouldn't have.
Fair enough. We're going to take the first piece of music, which is the Sally Gardens, which is the piece of music you love. Tell me about it, Pádraig.
Sally Gardens has been played by Bobby Gardner, my godfather, Jamesy, my mother's brother. He went off to America when he was about 18 years of age, and he and my mother were just two peas in a pod, and it broke her heart when he went away. And he actually came back when I was born, and he was my godfather, and he went back to America again, and I didn't see him for about, I was 14, 15 years of age, and he came back and he started playing the Sally Gardens for us, that tune. And he was an incredible box player, accordion player. And, you know, if there's somebody in your life that you really look up to, but you've never met, because he means so much to your mother or somebody who's close to you, and they speak about them all the time. And she would play Irish music on a cassette recorder. The Sally Gardens was her favourite. So this one is for you, Mom, and for Jamesy, because I know you're up there listening to us.
And you love it too, don't you, for almost a different reason?
I'm just so used to hearing it, I suppose, and hearing my grandfather sing it as well. Do you know, it's a nice childhood memory, is sitting in the kitchen listening to it and everyone having a smile on their face and being happy.
Oh, that was lovely. The Sally Gardens on the accordion played there by Bobby Gardner. You both love it. Eimear, take me back to the 17th of January last year.
Oh, that day started out pretty strangely. It was a Tuesday, so we go to print on a Tuesday and it's always pretty stressful in the office, and especially if anything happens in the Irish world, you've got to change a whole page, which in theory sounds really easy, but in practice takes a long, long time. Especially when we proof everything at least six times to make sure the Irish is right in it. So I get a phone call from Marie, a family friend who works with Dad as well, saying, your dad hurt his arm in the gym and he's in the hospital. We can't get your mum. Can you go pick him up? And of course, I was complaining and giving out because it's a Tuesday and I need to go to print. And why did he push himself so hard in the gym? And I've got to go pick him up now. So I'm driving into town and I call my boyfriend, Paul, who works in the hospital, just saying, can you call A&E to see if they're busy, how long he's going to be going through, what's the story? And in the meantime, then I get mum on the phone and I stop up at home to pick her up as well, because I don't know, I didn't really think. I thought that maybe she'd need a signature to get him out or something. they're going to keep
release
him forever. and then I'm sitting outside home waiting for mum, who has to have her morning cup of tea before she can go to the hospital. And I get a call from Paul just wondering where we are. And
your boyfriend's a doctor in Galway.
He's a doctor, yeah. He's in Max Vax in Galway. And Paul just says, I don't mean to alarm you, but you need to come in very quickly. And Paul is always a very calm person. So I was a little bit surprised for him to say that. So I called mom and said, put that into a flask. We're going straight in. So we went straight in. And Paul met us at the door to A&E. I dropped mom out of the car and he went upstairs with her. And I went on the eternal search for parking in Galway, which is next to impossible to find. Eventually I found a space and I came back and Paul met me again and passed on the news. And it was just a complete shock because he had hid it from us the whole time, just saying he's just in triage, not letting us know that Dad had actually had a massive heart attack. And you know, when he was calling me to say hurry up, it was very much touch and go. His heart had stopped, but he didn't want me to be driving in that shock, so he had hid it from us but tried to get us in as quickly as possible. So it was a strange day. Completely forgot about everything to do with the paper and everything else. It was just one concentration to make sure my mum and dad were okay. But by the time I got up to the room, he was sitting up and talking and back on his mobile phone like normal. but a strange day that I'll never forget.
And when Paul said to you that your dad had had a massive heart attack?
It was a shock, but it didn't really hit home until other tragedies like Paddy O'Shea had happened to realise, whoa, like it could have been a completely different story. We could be in a completely different place right now. Before it really, really hit home. It took that while to click as to what had happened.
Okay, you tell me what happened on that day, Paul.
Okay, Miriam. I'd arranged to meet Alan Mulholland Tuesday morning, 17th of January last. And Alan is the manager of the Galway football team. And we're talking about creating a strategy for the Galway football players, actually a mentoring program for each of the players. And I'd arranged to meet Alan that afternoon. But in the meantime, I had to actually change my plan. So I sent Alan a text at around 7 o'clock in the morning. I said, Alan, could you meet me around 9? And luckily, Alan was out of bed and he texted me back and he said, fine, meet you on Dominic Street. I went to the gym, as Eimear said, at 7:30, had a great session. Felt really good afterwards, went in and parked in Munster Avenue in Galway and met Alan. And we were having a cup of tea or coffee and I'm kind of breathing heavy because it kind of comes back to me, the kind of emotion of it now. So please excuse me for that. But after about 10 or 15 minutes talking to Alan, I started getting a pain on my left-hand side. I didn't know what it was, Miriam, because and I told Alan, I said, Alan, I got to go. I'm going to go to the doctor. I have a pain here. And he said, are you okay? I said, fine, yeah. So I made my way down to the car. was about 400 or 500 yards away, and I was parked in a side street. And I was there, slumped over the wheel of the car, literally dying. And the pain had overcome my whole body. For some reason, unknown to Alan and obviously unknown to me, Alan started looking for me and he started running down the streets, and the first place he looked, he found me. So Alan Mulholland saved my life. Something there, 5 minutes after I left, Alan decided, I wonder if that guy's okay. So Alan found me and he put me into the passenger seat of the car and he drove my car at speed to the hospital. There's no traffic on the road. There's usually very heavy traffic on the road. Got me there in a couple of minutes. Just like you, Emer, he was parked outside A&E and he had to move because he was in an emergency space for ambulances only, so he had to move. So he asked me, was I able to walk in, and I struggled. I got in. And this time the pain was 10 out of 10, and I can take pain, but I've never suffered anything like this. So I went up to the doctors and I said, there was a group of them together, and I said, look, I'm not feeling well, can you help me? And one of the doctors said to me, did you sign in at reception? And I said, no. And he said, well, we cannot see you until you sign in at reception. So I turned around to go to sign in at reception, if I got that far. And this young lady who was a trainee doctor or a nurse, broke rank and brought me into a cubicle. And I was lying in the cubicle with this serious pain on my left-hand side. And next thing was, I was lying on my side and I had thrown up. And there was a group of about maybe 6 or 7 or 8 doctors and nurses around, and somebody said, do you hear us? And I nodded, or I said yes or something like that. What happened that time, I didn't know until afterwards, was that my heart had stopped and they used CPR to get me back. And that got me back. And then they rushed me through a corridor, up a lift, and into a room that, when I looked up, I knew I was in an operating theatre. And the only time they spoke to me, they said, we've got to cut your clothes off. So they cut my clothes off. And I was there just looking up at the ceiling, and I knew it was an emergency. And the first thing I thought of is, thank God they don't know who I am, because I don't want Kathleen and the kids to know, because it's okay if they find out afterwards, because nobody asked me for my name. They did know who I was, but I didn't know at the time. So I was, you're totally conscious through all this stuff. I still didn't know what was wrong with me. And at one stage, I asked myself the question, because I knew I was touch and go. I said, Porrick, you might die here. Are you okay to move on? Are you okay with it that you could die? So I asked myself that. And before I answered, I asked myself two, to me, fundamental questions. One is, will Kathleen and the kids be okay after I die? And the answer I give is, yeah, they will. Second question I asked myself, did I give life the best shot I could? And I mean in a way of integrity. And trying not to do harm to anybody. And I said, yeah, unequivocally. I made lots of mistakes and I did things I know I shouldn't do, but that's life, we all do that. I'm only human, like everybody else. So then I said, and this is literally what I said. I said, God, I don't know if you're a man or a woman, but if my number is up, it's your call and I'm okay to move on. And then in my mind, I said to the doctors and nurses, I said, thanks for everything you've done. I really appreciate it. I want you guys to go home this evening to say, look, you gave it your best shot, but it didn't work out. So I had made peace with myself to move on. And then at some stage after that, I felt I was being anaesthetized. And my right leg started feeling as if it was being I wasn't being anaesthetized, but I thought I was. And I felt, this is great. Because one of two things are going to happen, Miriam. One is, I'm not going to wake up after it, that's it. The other thing that could happen is that I will wake up. But the great thing that's going to happen in that space, I'm not going to have any pain. So the pain was so intense that I just wanted the pain to go. But I also decided I'm going to fight for life as hard as I can with whatever is there in me to do so. And if I go, I go, but I'm not going to go without a fight. Next thing, I my back was off the theatre bed and my knees were kind of in the air. And I said, how did I get into this space? And there was somebody helping me lie down again. And actually what had happened, that was the second time my heart had stopped. And they put on the, what they call it, the jump leads, the defibrillator, to get me back. And that burst of electricity got me back again. Shortly after that, I felt I was able to talk. And the pain went from 10 out of 10 to probably about 7 or 8 out of 10. So there was one doctor or surgeon who was by my side all of the time. So I decided to ask him, and I felt like Christy Moore here. I said, how's it going? How are you getting on? And he totally ignored me. I decided I'm going to try something else. I said, what's your name? He said, I'm Kieran Daly. I didn't know Kieran Daly. I knew of him. He's one of the finest cardiologists in the country. And he saved my life. And I knew then there was something wrong with my heart because I knew he was a cardiologist. And afterwards he showed me what happened to me, and then they put in a stent. Then I was brought into a special cardiology space, and that's when Mom came in and you came in, and Kieran Daly came down after me and he said, look, you're going to be okay, you're very sick, you're extremely lucky and extremely fortunate, because Kieran Daly, first of all, Alan Mulholland found me in time. Secondly, there was no traffic on the road. Thirdly, I could have been in Dublin if he hadn't, on the road to Dublin on the motorway, if he hadn't replied to my text. You know, fourthly, there's one cardiology theatre in the hospital in Galway that was available at the time. It was free at the time. So many things happened, Miriam, that means that me and you and Emer are talking here today, and there are thousands of people listening, please God. Life is strange. I'm here for some reason. I don't know what the reason is. God. So that's it. That's the story.
When you saw him that first time, can you remember even what you said to him? Or
I remember being angry with him because he was on his mobile cancelling meetings and being like, give me that phone. Someone else can do that for you. It was really scary because there were lots and lots of machines hooked up to him. And because he was a really, really healthy person, you know, he'd run 13 miles every Sunday. He'd be in the gym every day. We were in the same gym at the time, and there's not a hope that I could do the same stuff he'd be doing or keep up with him. So it was just such a shock to see one of the strongest people in your life so vulnerable and so ill. And like Paul had explained, that it was very, very serious, and that it was his, what they called widow's artery, because seemingly it makes widows. It's, you know, if you have a heart attack with this artery being blocked, you're very unlikely to get out of it. So it was... I suppose, happiness to see that he was fine and able to be on his mobile, but, you know, anger that he was on his mobile, and then fear because someone was so strong had become so weak so quickly.
I wasn't on my mobile. I had the mobile with me, but I wasn't able to be on my mobile. So I wasn't, but they took it off me, though.
Good for them. But when you saw Kathleen and Emer and your other kids, well, how did you feel that time?
It was a strange type of feeling. I was obviously delighted to see them. I knew I'd be okay, but I didn't realise how close to death I was. And I hadn't realised at that stage that my heart had stopped twice and I was on the other side of the fence twice. But for the work of great nurses and doctors and Alan Mulholland's quick thinking, all of those, and the coincidences. And as only as Emer says, Paddy O'Shea, who was a really good friend of mine and a great Kerryman and an Irishman, it's only when he died and Mom, Kathleen and I went down to his funeral, and you'd see people like Paddy getting heart attacks and not getting the breaks you get. You question life.
Did it change you, that whole experience?
Oh, it did. It did, absolutely. It changed me quite a bit. The first thing I did was I very, very clear, I need to get out of Air Arran, because that's where a lot of the stress was. And I was very comfortable that Stobart's, who were my partners at the time and a great company, that they had the resources to actually bring the airline on further, so that 350 or so jobs were secure and the company could go on and achieve goals and visions that, quite frankly, I didn't have the resources to bring it to. And then I'm still working pretty hard, but I don't have the stress in my life that I used to have, and I'm a lot happier. And a lot of simple things can make us all happy. And, you know, Miriam, there's a lot of people in this country who are seriously stressed and in a very difficult position. Business people and people unemployed and people who are working with less salary. Mm. Guys, you're going to get through it. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Don't get too worked up on the small stuff. It's going to be okay.
But maybe if somebody had given you that advice before you had this heart attack, you might not have listened.
Miriam, people gave me that advice.
Yeah.
And you didn't listen, I bet. Exactly. I heard what they were saying, but I wasn't listening to them. I said, yeah, no, I'm fine. As Emer said, I run a marathons, half marathons and so on. Look, I'm sound. I'm fine, you know. But little did I realise, you know, and people who are seriously stressed very often don't realise they're seriously stressed until it's very late and sometimes too late in the day, you know. So just watch the candle light and
no,
and
I think it's
flow.
Really good advice you're giving to people.
That's become my little bugbear. If I'm ever at meetings or come across people that I see from the outside as being stressed or working very long hours and not taking any time off, I'm like, I could have been that girl who didn't have a daddy to walk down the aisle because he was so stressed and didn't take care of himself and realised that him taking care of himself meant so much to all those around him. It wasn't just for him personally, because he ate well, he didn't have any cholesterol, he didn't smoke, he doesn't drink much, he was fit. The only two factors were the fact that he was male and stressed. Nothing else had caused this but these two things. So it has become my personal bugbear to go up to random men I see or in meetings being like, watch out if you've got kids at home. Realise that how you're taking care of yourself affects them so much.
And were you aware that he was stressed? I suppose there was the examinership in 2010, wasn't there?
Well, like, we're always aware of him being stressed because he's always been stressed. You know, he would have been teaching and taking on so much more and having Irish colleges and Fianna, and there was always something there. Mm. But I don't think we ever realised what stress can do, you know, apart from a bad mood or not being around the house. We didn't realise exactly how stress could change our lives so much and how important it was to manage it until this happened to us.
Do you look at him differently now?
Possibly. He's a lot more vulnerable. Yeah. Yeah, you know, you're constantly worried if a phone call's not answered or if you're not back at the right time or if he's more tired than you expect. You know, you're constantly worried. Is there something else going on? Is there something sinister going on in the background? Which is something you would have never thought about before, but it's always there in the back of your head now.
Those kind of experiences, some people say, make them more spiritual or make them think about that side of life more. Did that experience have that effect on you, Pádraig?
Yes, it did. It did. The second time when my heart had stopped, something happened to me. And it's kind of difficult to say this because I don't know what space I was in, but I was in a space where I actually was in a darkened room, and it wasn't the operating theatre that I was in my consciousness, and it was a darkened room, and there were other people in that, and I mean darkened, it was pure black, but not a scary black, it was a warm black, and I wasn't afraid or anything like that. But there were other people there. There was one person I could see clearly, the other people I couldn't see clearly, a man in his mid-40s who had receding hair. He was about 5'9", 5'10". He had a dark jacket with a dark shirt on him. The shirt was brighter than the jacket, and I could see him from the waist up. And I don't know, was that hallucination or I don't know what it was, but there was, to me, there was something real and tangible there. Now, getting on to spirituality, that's me as part of spirituality, and spirituality has been important to me, quite frankly, all of my life. I don't mind what religion people are because it's nothing got to do with religion. But spirituality is about a sense of self, but it's about a sense of community, about the sense of commitment, self-commitment and commitment to others, self-respect and respect of others, and the sense that there's greater in the collectiveness than there is in the individual. And I built a relationship with Michael Kelleher, who's the provost or the lead of the Redemptorist in Ireland, and others, great people. And I created a centre of spirituality excellence in Esker. And it's a place where actually you can dive in and dip into the well of spirituality and get a sense of self-worth, collective worth and so on, and go away, go home again after your weekend or day or a week long trip there. So, yeah, spirituality is really important.
Have you been there, Emer?
No, I haven't. No, I would believe in spirituality as well, but I suppose in my own little way, you know. Anytime I see a white feather on the ground, I always think there's an angel looking down on me, one of those loved ones that we've lost. So I gain my hope from that kind of stuff and go through with that. And, you know, as Dad said, I'm a fraidy cat. I have to have the light on every single night when I'm going to bed. But I've seen people at the end of my bed who give me such solace and make me feel at ease at times when there's stuff going on that I don't even realise it's going on. But I believe that they're my angels looking down on me.
I find it so interesting when people do believe in guardian angels. That guy you saw in the blackened room, who was he?
I don't know.
Right, he wasn't anyone you would
know. Yeah. No, I don't know. Didn't recognize. I was able to see him as well as I can see you now. I don't think it was, and people could say, and it may have been, my mind playing tricks with me. I don't know. I'm just being totally, totally open and honest with you. You know?
Which brings us to our next piece of music, because you've both been talking about Kathleen, your wife and your mom, and the song you want to dedicate to her.
Yeah, it's called Up Where We Belong by Joe Cocker, I think, and Jennifer Ward. It's a few years now, so it is. When we got married, we got a CD. It wasn't CD done, then a tape video done of it in those days. And the guy who did it had put this down as the theme music for our wedding, and it's Up Where We Belong. And it's an inspirational piece of music, and hopefully people will enjoy listening to it.
And you're 30 years married this week.
We're 30 years married, the 19th of March.
Okay.
Tuesday.
Well, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Up Where We Belong, Jennifer Warnes and Joe Cocker. Emer, you've made a great success of Fuintia. Are you planning to stay there for the long term, or are you going to be like your dad and head off and try lots of other things?
For me, when I started off at Fuintia, the Irish language is very, very important to me, and I'm a primary school teacher by trade. So I wanted to get the language back there and make sure that there was an Irish language paper there to keep the language alive. And I feel like I've done that with great success. I feel like there's a lot more that can be done with it, but I'm not so sure I'm settled there for the rest of my life. I'm always looking for new challenges and new things to keep the mind ticking and going. So I'm not ready to stand still yet, but I don't know where I'm going to go to.
Do you miss Air Aran?
No. I miss the staff. I miss the people there. They're incredible people in the company. But no, it's really important when your time has come and you move on. And I'm very comfortable doing that. And I am delighted I was involved in Air Aran. I'm delighted to have been a founder of Air Aran. Very, very privileged to work with incredible people in a crazy industry. Like, Kenny Rogers has a great song called The Gambler. You need to know when to hold them, when to fold them, when to walk away and when to run.
Do you think in Ireland people often say we don't have the right attitude to business? That, in other words, in America, say you have a business and ultimately it goes into examinership or receivership, that you can move on, pick yourself back up and keep going. But here people regard things as a big failure, and we look at it in a different way to, say, America.
There's two ways, Miriam, I can answer that question. Just over 2 years ago now, we were having a board meeting about putting Air Aran into examinership. I had no difficulty in doing that whatsoever. I didn't feel like a failure. I felt like I wish it hadn't go there. It didn't have to go there. Actually, I didn't feel stressed at all at that. That did not stress me, because it was the best thing or the only thing available to the company at that stage. So during the examinership, the number of people who flew with Air Aran increased by about 20% during that period, Irish people. And the level of support and emails and text messages and people I didn't even know on the street in Dublin saying, "Keep going. I wish you luck." It was incredible. It was absolutely powerful. So this sense of, and there is a certain amount of sense of certain amount of begrudgery or whatever it is, but genuinely, it's way overplayed. It's nowhere near where some people think it is. You have a small little sector of the community who've got that ingrained negativity. But it's so small, Miriam, and certainly 99.9% of the public out there are with you 100%.
Was it like a death in the family almost when he left Air Aran?
It was really difficult because everyone he works with are his family and friends. So, you know, leaving all them behind was a very, very difficult process for him. And it was also very strange. I mean, it's been there since I was in primary school. So it's always, you know, there's always been Air Aran there and it's always... but I think it was good for him and it was a step that he needed to take for him and for us as a family. So, you know, we were happy when it finally came around.
So you've gone on to launch loads of other businesses, haven't you?
Yeah, I've recently set up a home care business looking after elderly and others at home called Costla Home Care. Sure, look, I'm reinventing myself.
And tell me about the Entrepreneur of the Year. You're very involved, head of the judges, the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur. The closing date is next Sunday, isn't it?
Closing date is next Sunday and it's an incredible competition. It's been run and sponsored by Ernst & Young. And to me, it's the fulcrum of the development and creation of innovation, entrepreneurship, creativity, and giving all of that a kind of a very, very public image. When Air Aran were involved in the Entrepreneur of the Year program, like the profile it gave me, but in particular the company, was incredible. The staff felt totally invigorated by being up there and being one of the 24 finalists. Our passengers felt really good and said, this is a great thing. And it actually stood by the company for years and years and years and years onwards in relation to a benchmark and credibility.
Because you won it in 2003, didn't you?
I won it in 2003, yeah. But it's easy to say it's not about the winning, it's the 24 finalists. So I would hugely encourage anybody who's thinking of getting involved, please do so. Get in your application form. Dairy Master in Kerry won it last year. An incredible company in just in the countryside in Kerry. And Ed and the team there will be representing Ireland with the green, white and gold in Monte Carlo next June. And, you know, whoever is listening, go for it. Put in the application form. You can do it online. Business, it's a very lonely place to be, Miriam, when you're up there. And there's a lot of stress, as we spoke about earlier on it. But if you're a part of the entrepreneurial community, you can actually go and ring somebody. You can have a chat. You can have a coffee with somebody or just over the phone and say, look at what do I do here? And you know, there isn't one person in the country who has not been where you've been. Doesn't matter how low you are, there are other people who've been there. So go out and reach out, because you know something? There's also the top of the hill and we all can reach.
And remind people again who are listening, who are going through tough times or struggling at the moment in business, give them your worldly advice.
Well, John Wayne once said, when you're on a dead horse, get off. If your company is not working, you know, face facts, don't keep pushing the ball or pushing the boat out. Be realistic. Secondly, a business, it's only a business. Businesses come and go. Miriam, I've never seen a company grow in my life. Companies don't grow. People grow. So you focus on people. And you cannot focus on people unless you focus on yourself first. Make sure you're healthy. You're good. Because the stress I went through, that Emer and everyone in my family suffered as a result of it. I didn't realise they were suffering, but they were suffering as a result of it. So it has got a lot of potentially collateral damage. And it breaks marriages. Thank God it didn't break my marriage. I almost lost my health on it. So it's not worth that. Just walk away from it if it ain't working. And talk to people. And that's a great thing about the Entrepreneur of the Year programme. There are so many people you can talk to who are genuine people who will say, this is what I did. Come and let's talk about it. And there's help available out there because you are important.
Yeah, it's something I've taken on myself. Until last June, I hadn't taken a day off from when I first bought Fuintia. I may not have been in the office every day, but I was at the end of the phone. I was answering emails. But, you know, having seen the importance of, you know, work isn't absolutely everything. It's important to give it your best. But, you know, you can only do as good as your body. And you need to make sure that you're okay. So I took a holiday for a week and then I came back a completely new person and was so much more productive after giving a break and listening to my body and to my mind.
Well, that's really good advice from both of you. But we're going to go out now on a piece of music, which is...
The Galway Girl. I like to think...
I wonder why you like it.
I'd like to think that I'm a Galway girl, if only they could change the line to say brown eyes rather than blue. But yeah, no, it's a great song. It always causes everyone to get up and dance. And I think it captures the atmosphere of, of Galway always being up for a bit of crack and up for a laugh. And it's important to think of the good times and let go and enjoy yourself and be with those that make you happy and that you love. So yeah, it's a great song.
It's a fantastic song. If somebody does want to enter the Entrepreneur of the Year quickly, how do they do that?
Go on the Ernst & Young website and there's an application form there. And Frank O'Keefe, who's the partner in charge in Ernst & Young, will make sure that is taken from there.
Okay, well, look, Pádraig O'Keefe, the very best of luck with everything
you
do.
Much.
And Emer O'Keefe, you too. I hope you both go from strength to strength. My thanks on sound today to Nikki Dempsey, to my producer Eileen Heron, and we're going out listening to the wonderful Galway Girl.
I took a stroll down the old long walk of a day. I met a little girl and we stopped to talk on a fine soft day. And I ask you, friend, what's a fella to do? 'Cause her hair was black and her eyes were blue. And I knew right then I'd be taking the world down the Salt Hill Prom with a Galway girl.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.